People at Radio Mayside didn't like me. They thought I was very common. The success of people like me is due to having good management. You try and think of a different introduction to the same record day after day after day.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Billy Butler.
Young Billy growing up was basically in the Anfield area of Liverpool. I grew up living with my grandparents because we'd lost my dad at an early age. So there's myself, my grandparents, my mum and four other kids in the house. Had a wonderful childhood, enjoyed every single minute of it. Didn't drink much because we didn't in those days, the post wouldn't let you in. I did manage to pass the scholarship and went to the Liverpool Collegiate School where I filled out that my ambition was to be an accountant, which the headmaster thought was hysterical. Left there, got a job in a plumber's merchants. Main hobby was listening to music, listening to Radio Luxembourg, trying desperately to get AFN. And to get a signal that stayed during the day because AFN had the Lone Ranger on and things like that.
So let's thrill once again as we turn back many years to the wild and untamed west of old. The Lone Ranger rides again.
And they played records before anywhere else. Luxembourg was the next best, and apart from that, there was a home service and lights programme, which I don't think we listened to at all, maybe except Educating Archie of a Sunday afternoon and Round the Horn and Take It From Here. All those variety shows, and of course the greatest serial ever on radio, Journey into Space, which we used to listen to every Monday night and talk about it all day at school the next day.
Journey into Space. The BBC presents Jet Morgan in Operation Luna.
Got a job at American Express. And during that time, I auditioned for a television programme called Thank You Lucky Stars up in Didsbury in Manchester, where there were three teenagers on a panel and they played the latest American releases and asked us to comment on them, which I did. And I was sitting there watching everybody auditioning and they all knew as much as I did about the music. So I thought, I'm not going to impress them with my knowledge because they're all very knowledgeable. I'll try and be a little bit light-hearted, which he did. The thing I remember was one of his new dances, I think it was called The Jerk or something like that. And I remember saying that I think we should find this dance very popular because apparently during this dance you throw your partner over your shoulder. So if you had it around with your girlfriend, it's a great thing to get up to dance with, you know. So that was that, and Thank You Lucky Stars started, and I used to watch it week after week looking at the panel saying, I was as good as him, I was as good as him. And then I think it was in January 61 or something like that, where I got a note saying, come down to Birmingham and record Spinny Disc, which was part of the Lancashire Stars program. Brian Matthew was the compa.
The very first week we did this, there were two kids on there. Was a chap called Bill Butler, who then became a disc jockey on Liverpool local radio, and there was Janice Nichols, who was a little darling brummy girl with a most mile-wide Birmingham accent. And when it came to marking records, Janice would say, if she really liked a piece, I'll give you five.
Brian, he always came over to me as very officious. Bearing in mind he was doing a programme, we rehearsed twice during the day, but he was very friendly and he was always interested in what was going on where we were from. I did that and was delighted at being on telly, you know. And then 2 weeks later I got a note saying, would you come back on and do it again? And that happened for the next 15 or 16 weeks. I'd leave of a Sunday, never knowing it was on again the next week, till I got a telegram on the Wednesday. And basically that was my start in showbiz. And of course, he got more interested as we got into 1962 because of the Beatles. The best things in life are free. What happened next was that because I was on Thank You Lucky Stars, we decided to form a group. And we formed a group called the Cherry Pickers. They were very successful. So we formed a group called the Hangmen. They weren't very successful. And then around about that time, the Merseybeats asked me to be their guest on one of their nights at this club in Bootle. It was the Merseybeats guest night, and the Beatles were amongst the guests. And they asked me, would I go along? And they billed me as a mystery TV celebrity.
When the night is cold and my arms want someone to hold, I think of you.
So I went along and I got up with the major beats. I had a mask on, whipped the mask off after the first number. And it was the headlines in the Bootle Times the next day. It said, Big Cigar Man Hits Town. Because one of the things they did on Thank You Lucky Stars was when a certain Mr. Savile was the guest DJ, I brought a giant cigar with me and I made my comments with this giant cigar. And I was with the Maisie Beats for a while, actually, just as a guest. But the only time the Maisie Beats had been on the front cover of Maisie Beat magazine was with me. And they've never forgiven me for it. So I left them and formed a group called the Tuxedos. And one day I was playing football for the Maisie Beat 11. And I came out for half time. And Bob Waller was doing the commentating, the cabin DJ. And he said to me, Billy, I'm not very good at this. Would you do the second half? So I did the second half. And after it, Bob said to me, listen, Billy, this will be in late 63, early 64. He said, listen, Billy, I'm very, very busy at the cavern at the moment, as you can imagine, and I wouldn't mind another voice there. Would you like to come down and have a go? I said, certainly, yeah. So early 64, I went down to the cavern, did two sessions, and Bob said, right, if you want to work here, doing five lunch times, five evening sessions and an all-night session, we'd love it. So I said, fine. I think I was getting about £6 a week or something like that. But my wage at work at that time was only £3. So even though I was working long hours, it was well worth it. And it all went on from there, actually. When I think of the cavern, I think of how small the band room was for a start. Because on all-night sessions, we'd have 10 groups on. So you can imagine this. It wasn't much bigger than this room, the cavern band room. There'd be a little cupboard which had the record player in it. And we'd have a microphone there, and we'd talk into the microphone over the system, play our own records, our own vinyl, which Bob used to have, and then I started buying them as well. We'd have a programme for the groups to go on. We'd tell them if they didn't turn up on time for their spot, they'd get moved to last. Bob's edict used to always be group 10 minutes in between playing records, another group 10 minutes in between playing records. And because of that, it seemed to work. The band room was sacred territory as far as Ray McFaw was concerned. He was the owner. So we couldn't bring any girls in the band room or nothing like that. We couldn't bring any drink in the band room or nothing like that because we never knew when there was going to be a... And Ray McFaw would walk in, which obviously limited activities a great deal because we sold no drink at the cavern till 66, 67. They never sold alcohol at all. And it was just a mad gig. I mean, I saw some great bands because we had a lot of bands from London, we had a lot of bands from Birmingham, a lot of bands from Manchester, so and a lot of American guests as well, really big stars like Muddy Waters, Solomon Burke, Rufus Thomas, John Lee Hooker, all people like that, but as well as all our local bands as well. Because it was one of many beat clubs in Liverpool. You know, we had the Iron Door not far away over the road. They did sessions as well. And the City Centre was full of clubs doing sessions, and none of them sold beer, apart from the Mardi Gras and the Downbeat. They sold beer.
Love, love me do. You know I love you.
Basically, obviously, I met the Beatles. Be going down to the cavern. I saw them on the cavern many, many times, and at St John's Hall and other venues in Liverpool. I first met them when there was an all-night session at the cavern, and the Beatles were on, and they were interested in me because I was on telly every week. You see, I was the star then. I was on telly every week, you see, and they were asking me about some of the people like Bo Diddley who'd been on and Gene Vincent had been on, and what they were like. And I remember George Harrison said to me, "Billy said, when you don't think you're Lucky Stars again?" I said, "Well, it's actually next Saturday." "Oh, can you mention the Beatles?" And I said, "Well, I can't, George, because I'm singing with the Maisie Beats at the moment, and they get annoyed, you know." And I've met them on and off since. We did two all Merseyside shows on Thank You Lucky Stars, where every act was from Merseyside, and I was guest on both of them, so I met them then. That was the time when we were doing all the shows then from Birmingham, from Aston Green. And for just that period of time, a few seconds, I was one of the Beatles. Because we were up on the fourth floor, thousands of people downstairs in the street. Myself and Paul and George and John, Paul, George and Ringo, were sitting by the window looking down at them. And Paul stood up and waved. And of course, down there, five flights up, you just see the mop top and screaming their heads off, you know. So George stood up and waved and he screamed their heads off. And Ringo stood up and waved and he screamed their heads off. And Paul said to me, why don't you be John? So I stood up and waved and thousands of people screamed. So it was just for that short time I was a Beatle, you know. And I've interviewed Paul quite a few times since. Interviewed Ringo once. Never got round to interviewing George, unfortunately. And for Pete Best, who was the original drummer with the Beatles, I went to school with Pete, and we all thought he was going to make a great rugby player because he's brilliant as a rugby player. He was in our first team there. Lovely man as well. What happened next was I was DJing at the Cavern, and the Cavern closed just for that little while, so I had to go and look for more work. So I worked at a club in Wigan called the Paradise Club. And we started doing mobile discos in Wales because I was very big on Northern Soul. So we'd go out and do discos in North Wales. We'd hire a pub and put the show on ourselves and keep the door money. But it usually worked out that once it became popular, the manager of the pub would say, I'll do this myself, and he'd tear you out, you know. So that was at the Cavern. But and then I started working at the Mardi Gras and the Cavern. After the Cavern reopened, I went back to work at the Cavern. But I also started working at the Mardi Gras Club, which was in Mount Pleasant. And the downbeats of a Friday night, we used to have American acts on, and we put them on at the downbeats, 9 o'clock, and it was only about half a mile away, over to the Mardi Gras for 11. So I had to go and introduce them at the downbeats, make sure they get out and over to the Mardi Gras for 11. Mainly American soul bands, some of them pretend American soul groups, you know. And I was DJing at the Mardi Gras one night when Tony Wolfe, who worked here at Radio Merseyside, came to see me and he said, listen, Billy, Kenny Everett has taken the Saturday mornings off. We're not very happy with the guys who replaced him. Would you like to have a go on Merseyside on a Saturday morning between 9 and 11? And I said, yeah, I'd love that, you know. So I went and did the Saturday morning show.
Radio Merseyside on the BBC.
When Radio Merseyside started, I did a spot on board the boat. The launch was on the Royal Irish, and I did a spot on the boat with my go-go dancers, the Beer Essentials, they were called. And I thought maybe they'll spot me, but no, they never did.
Next Wednesday, BBC Local Radio comes to Liverpool and Merseyside.
Radio, 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 radio.
But I think it was because of my work at the Cavern and my work at the Mardi and the fact that I was a name in Liverpool that Tony Wolfe came and offered me the job. 71 I started at Merseyside. And apparently the people at Radio Merseyside didn't like me. They thought I was very common. But I got more mail for that Saturday morning spot than anybody else did on the show. Mainly because I was just being myself. And I don't think I had anybody on Radio Merseyside at the time, maybe apart from Pete Price, who was themselves. Understand what I mean? After that, they offered me three mornings a week. It was weird. I'd do Monday, somebody else would do Tuesday. I'd do Wednesday, somebody else would do Thursday. And I'd do Friday, which was a weird setup, but that was the BBC. And if I remember, it was a weird time. I think it was half past eight till quarter past ten or something like that. The premises were quite good. It was on the sixth floor, two studios, basically. It was quite good. We had two studios, must have been three studios, and a main room where we could put live stuff on, but we never did. Can't complain about the record library and everything. In fact, in all fairness, David, we did more then than we do now. We were more adventurous in them days than we are now. You know, with it being new and with the BBC up, probably, we're probably doing things that we weren't allowed to do. But we did it because we're going all out for listeners. I've always said that anybody's success is helped by the people at the top. Because I'm a great believer in doing it. And then if they don't like it, the bosses don't like it, they'll come down and tell you. Whereas if I'd gone and asked them, they might have said no straight away. So do it. And if you get away with it, keep on doing it. You know, don't ask. You'll get told if you can't do it, you know. And I used to do it. I used to do shows live from people's houses. It was called Butler at Large. We'd do a show live from someone's house at 5 o'clock at night with just a radio car and a microphone up the road into the front room. And I did this one night a week. And a couple of guys listening to the show owned a mobile ice cream van. And they realised that when we were doing these live shows in people's houses, there was lots of kids and mums and dads came along. So every time we did a live show, there was this guy in his ice cream van, you know, who followed us around. Yeah, we did shows where I was driving a bus. I'd drive a bus. We did one for aboard a train where my producer, I jumped on the train and my producer didn't get on it in time. So I was on my own on it with no microphone and nothing. It was just adventurous. It was great days. It really was. Because I used to do a programme on Sunday called Ring a Winner, where we played five records and people had to vote to say which record they liked the best. They'd come online, they'd tell us why they liked it and everything, and at the end of the show we'd totter up and say this the Ring a Winner record of the week is this one. Actually, I was incredibly posh. Sometimes I listen to myself and I can't believe I'm saying, is that me? I'm talking more refined. I don't know why it was, but I certainly sounded much better then, class-wise, than I do now. And it was a matter of doing everything you could to get in the public eye. Like, I'd do fates every week if I had to. Go and open fairs, go and take part in events, anyway, go and talk to someone. It was just a matter of getting out there and making sure everybody knew about Radio Merseyside and about the station and whatever. We used to go to do a lot of things, and we did the Liverpool show, we did the St Helens show, we'd have a marquee over at the New Brighton show, we'd put groups on, we'd have comedians on, and we had product because I came up with this idea in the 70s. I found that I'd be playing records on the show, and people would ring up and say, where can I get this? And I'd say, go to HMV or M's, or and he didn't have them. The records, because I think the 70s became the era when it was, the shops would only stock the top 40. So apart from the specialist shops, I'd be playing stuff that nobody could get. Or I'd get behind an oldie from the early 60s and play it to death because I knew people liked it. It's knowing your audience, that's part of everything. So I came up with this idea of doing an LP, it was at the time, called The Hits You Couldn't Get. I'd put on 16 or 17 of records I'd been playing, old and new, which my listeners had been saying he just couldn't get hold of. And then I'd get in touch with the company, CBS, Decca, AMI, licensed them, and then we'd sell them over in reception. And all the money we got paid for station resources. Like we'd get extra people and use them on the back of what we were making on stuff like that. You know, and we could go out to events and have lots of product for sale. But we did that for 4 years. Yeah. And for 4 years, that was the best-selling album in Liverpool. Beats everything else. The management were great. I've always said, you know, the success of people like me is due to having good management who tolerate you, who say to themselves, he knows his job, you leave him to it. And there was one massive mistake I made when, on April Fool's Day, I announced that Liverpool FC was on fire. Right. Jokingly, you know, then they say we've had more news about the fire at Anfield. The fire engines are there now. They're doing all they can. You say. And then at the end of the show, my punchline was going to be that it wasn't the ground was on fire. It was Tommy Smith's shorts. They just thought it was the ground. You see. But all hell broke loose because the fire engines went there. You see, and I remember the headline in the Echo, what a silly Billy, you know. And I got in serious trouble with the boss over that, and they wouldn't let me work on April Fool's Day for years. It was great. We'd have bags of mail, you know, sackfuls of mail, you know, because we could do competitions then. We can't give anything away now. So you could do competitions for I mean, I'd do competitions for the prize is a box of Goodison Park. And we'd send people a box to stand on if they go to the match. You know, we'd give away an autographed photo of Michael Jackson, which was signed by me. Like, I never said it was Michael Jackson who'd autographed it. You know, we'd try and bring variety in with the good prizes, you know, with the CDs, the albums, things that are sneered at by today, but the people loved concert tickets, albums, you know, they loved it. The daft competitions, but I just do it, as I said, you know. We did competitions like, we did one where people strip while they're on air. We'd phone them at home and they'd tell us exactly what they're wearing. Right, and every time I got a question wrong, they had to take something off. What are you taking off now, love? I'm just taking off my cardigan. And what's underneath that? I've got a blouse. And we did one called Take Your Chick, which was stolen from Take Your Pick. And we'd, the prize would be a full chicken, but they'd have to answer the question for a leg. It was like a Beatle game. They'd answer the question for a leg, then another leg, then a thigh, and then for the whole chicken. You know, understand what I mean? And we actually did, this is absolutely true, this, you know, Dave, not made up. We also did one where we'd have two people on the phone, right? I'd be here, we'd have a caller on that, on the caller phone, and the caller on, say, caller on phone A would be hiding in the house. And caller on phone B had to question the person in the house to try and find out where in the house they were hiding. That sounds ridiculous, but we did it, you know.
It's 2 minutes to six on Monday, October the 21st, 1974. For the very first time, this is 194 Radio City, broadcasting to Merseyside.
It's new on Merseyside, the Radio City sound. Stay tuned to 194 for the sound that's getting around.
By the time Radio City started, you know, that meant we had to kick up the arse. We had to, go up a base, you know, which we did. We just had to up our game, you know. We got told to think of different things. Let's go out and do more OBs. And when City started, we actually did a week of live broadcasts in town. I did my show live from a big store in Liverpool called Lewis's. And we competed that way, you know, and we were ahead then. I think then we were only on VHF, actually.
Radio Merseyside will broadcast on VHF at a frequency of 95.85, bringing high-quality radio coverage of every activity that has made Merseyside what it is today.
And it was later on we moved on to medium wave, which might sound daft, but we thought that was a real thing, because people listened to medium wave in them days, not VHF, you know. And basically it was that. I mean, City started, I think, 74, and they approached me to come and work for them, you see. So I went and saw them and all that, and we agreed that I'd leave and everything. But Terry Smith, not the easiest of men in the world to get on with, he wouldn't tell me what time I was on, you see. And I have this sneaking suspicion in my mind, maybe they want me to go there just to get rid of me. And they put me on late at night or something. Now, at that time, I was still working at American Express in town, which was very difficult at times, because I was still doing my morning show from 8 till up. I think it was half 8 to 9:45 or something then, weird times. I used to come in and do my radio show, but I had to tell the people, I'd tell the boss at work it wasn't live, that I'd recorded it. So I couldn't mention the weather or anything like that, you see. Because, so I'd come off here at 10:30, 10:45, and shoot down to Gladstone Dock or to talk to the doctor, get me job done, go back into work at 1 o'clock and say, here's what I've done this morning, you see. So I was still working at the same time as doing me radio job. So I said to Rex Borden, he said to me, why are you leaving? So I told him, you know, I said, I'm only on 3 days a week. I said, if you can guarantee me 5 days a week and pay me enough so I can pack my day job in and concentrate on working for you, I'll sign for Radio Merseyside. And they said, great, that's fine, Will. So I did that. That was 74. Then 77 came along, and Radio City were getting very adventurous then. They were doing big outdoor shows. They were doing this, that and the other, which we couldn't compete with, or we wouldn't do. And I was on my recorder, said to me, you won't be a success over there. So I thought, oh, won't I? So I left, you know, as simple as that. 194, Radio City. Well, my time in the 70s, that was great. It was very adventurous. We were doing a lot of things that commercial stations only could do. The difference I always found was that the DJs didn't support each other. They were all... Like, if I went to another DJ and said to him, I've got a great idea for a competition for your show, the other jocks would say, why did you give him that idea? You know, he might do well, but so what? We're part of a station. It's the station that matters. And I think with the BBC, it's always worked that way. The staff at the BBC have always been more close-knit. You know what I mean? I've always found that they believed in the station more than the people at commercial radio do. They believe in themselves more than anything else. And I was very lucky, actually, the first time there, because they never imposed the musical on me. They still let me play what I like playing, you see. One of the things I remember most of all was when Foster and Allen brought out A Bunch of Time, and I started playing it like mad, you know. And Dave Lincoln, who was head of music then, I said, what are you playing that stuff for? It's rubbish. I said, not in Liverpool, it's not. It's not rubbish in Liverpool. And, of course, it became massive. Mike Berry record, Sunshine Your Smile, was the same. I got behind that like mad, and I was getting told, why are you playing that? You know, looking sharp, this is Liverpool. We've got to know what we like here before we do it.
Dear face that holds so sweet a smile for me.
I think one of the biggest failures I had of a competition was when Wally and I decided to come up with a radio form of pontoon, you see. I think I might have been to Vegas beforehand or something and thought, I would turn this into a radio show. So we did. So we recorded a great big pile of Ace of Diamonds, Five of Diamonds, Nine of Diamonds, things like that. Put them in the cassette, because they were all on cassette machines then, you know. So we'd have to call on the line, OK, caller, here's your first card. And we press a button and it'd say, Nine of Diamonds, right. Here's we can't tell you what my first card is because the banker has his card down, doesn't he? So there's your second card, Seven of Diamonds. What do you want to do, stick or twist? I'll twist, nine down, bust, you know. But if they won, I think they got a fiver or something like that. So I'd be the banker, and it's my card, Nine of Diamonds, Seven of Diamonds, 60, and I'll stick, I beat you, right? We lost about £400 in the first week. So the boss put the blocks on it. We must be the only card players in history who've lost on something like pontoon. And I spent four really good years at City. And then Ian Judson came along to see me. He said, listen, my boy, he said, you're at the wrong place. He wasn't Jewish, that's my accent. So I came back. I think it was 83, I think it was.
Through the years, we've been sharing songs together. You and me and Radio Merseyside.
Well, Hold Your Plums came up because I did a programme at City called Heads and Tails. Basically, they'd phone in, answer a question. We'd have this sound effect, coin dropping down, heads. Another coin dropping down, tails, they've lost. If they get two heads, they've won. If they get two tails, they've won. They've lost. Very, very popular, because it's something everybody could play. You know, the most successful quiz games on telly are the ones you can play yourself at home and imagine it. So when I got moved over to Merseyside, I started doing it again here. And Radio City decided to sue us. And I said, no, you can't do that, because it was my idea. The show was my idea. So he got on to Wally, who was still at City then, Wally Scott, and he said, who's our this? He said, it was Billy's. So they still said they were going to take legal action. The boss called me and said, are we all right on this? I said, yeah, we're all right, it was my idea. And I could see his voice, well, I'll tell you what, I'll come up with another idea. So I thought to myself, LCD, lowest common denominator, right? Throw coins up and, you know, what else? Slot machines. Right, play slot machines. Okay, do the same thing with that. Answer the question, pull the slot machine's arm and it'll go bell, plum, cherry, or cherry, plum, bell. And just to make it a bit spicy, we'd have the nudges out, because on the machines it'd say nudge, you know, but it has a different connotation in Liverpool. That's why I picked it, the nudges out. So I went to the boss with the idea. Hey, great idea, Billy. Yeah, this is Ian Judson, God love him. Great idea. What are you going to call it? I said, Hold Your Plums. He said, oh, I'm not too happy about the title. I said, that's what I want to call it, Hold Your Plums. He said, well, listen to me, wee lad. What I'll do, he said, when we send in our programmes for the next Radio Times, I'll send it in with the programmes. If they publish it, we'll do it. And they did. So we did it.
Britain's brightest radio show, Hold Your Plums.
Radio Merseyside.
And basically, Hold Your Plums is just an ordinary phone-in game. And without being big-headed, it was the skill of giving the contestants a clue, which baffled them. But the people at home, because we tell the people at home the answer first anyway, most of the time. So, I mean, we had things like people... A lot, luckily, we've got a big pile of Hold Your Plums I'd kept. So all the stuff which is supposed to be legendary, it's true, and we can prove it, you know. We do have a lady who was asked what was the name of this ship in Mutiny on the Bounty who didn't know it. We did have a lady who thought the first woman on Earth was Granny Smith because we told her to think of an apple, and she said Granny Smith. All these people were there. A lot of people say, you know, don't people know Ojo Plums were thick? They weren't thick at all.
Your question is on sport.
Let me give you an example. One of the questions we asked was, what sporting object is covered in dimples? You see, that was the question. I remember the lady was Margie. She said, oh, I'm no good at sport, Billy. I said, well, just think about it. What sporting object is covered in dimples? Well, yeah, the answer is, of course, a golf ball, you see. So I said, just have a guess. And she said, is it a sumo wrestler's ass? You see. Now, I often use this on stage to contest the being thick because I couldn't have thought of another answer to a golf ball. She did. You understand what I mean? So it was just ordinary people. I mean, I keep getting asked all the while now to bring Ojo Plums back. And I wouldn't because, A, it's so iconic. And B is because the people on it were funny because they were funny. If I did it again, the people who know Ojo Plums would try and be funny. And that'd kill it.
What do you call them things that swim around, Lil? And they're very friendly and they have them all in aquariums. They've got little holes in the top of their head and they squirt water out of them and they play with everyone. Very friendly fish. Flipper was one, love.
Oh?
Flipper. Remember Flipper?
Is it Andy Dolphin?
Yes! So Flipper was a...
A dolphin.
Yeah, a dolphin.
Yeah, so what was Hitler's Christian name?
Flipper.
When Ojo Plums started, it was just me in the studio. And by that time, Wally come over. Wally didn't come over for a year after I left. He came back then. So Wally was the old type of producer. Wally was a producer who thought of ideas for the show. Didn't just answer the phones, didn't make sure your balances were right. He took part in the show. Because that initially happened when I was at City. I'd call Wally in to talk to him, you see. And then at the end of the week, he'd go upstairs and the boss would bollock him. What are you doing on Billy's show? It's Billy's show. Well, he keeps calling me in. Well, don't go in. So I'd say, wait a minute. No, I can't come in. It's my show. Come in. The ratings are great. So, you know. So basically, we were probably one of the first producer presenters to do a two-way on air. Everybody does it now. And so when he came over to here, we just more or less continued the way it had been. It was successful then. And then we also started doing... I'm a great believer in getting involved and meeting people. So we started doing the Billy and Wally nights out. You know, we'd book a social club. In fact, first of all, when my first spell at Merseyside, every Christmas I used to hire a club, the Shakespeare Club in town, very big club. And I'd say to the Shakespeare Club, what do you charge me to hire your club? And they'd say so-and-so. And I'd say, what if we fill it? Well, what's it? Well, we fill it. They're all drinking, aren't they? Yeah. So if you pay for the cabaret and we have the club for nothing, and I guarantee I'll fill it, they said, OK. So every Christmas, I used to do a free Christmas show for all of our listeners. First, say 1,000 people to write in, go along to the Christmas show, meet all the Radio Merseyside presenters. You have a great Christmas show for nothing. So more or less what we did when Wally came back, we started doing Billy and Wally shows around all the social clubs. And then I continued doing what I was doing before in the 70s. Whenever it was our birthday, we'd book the Empire and put a show on. Or if there was something good in town, we'd book the Empire and put it on. And we sold everyone out. Joe Longthorne was just a little vocalist when he first started to come to Liverpool. But I realised that this guy was somebody people in Merseyside would love. And they still do now. So we started putting Joe on the Empire until he became too big. Daniel O'Donnell was the same. We started putting him on at theatres and clubs, and then he became too big, you know. And it's a matter, it's a way of getting... There might have been people who went there who never listened to Radio Merseyside, but they might have done after they left. Wally wasn't happy here for some reason. He didn't think we were appreciated. Being appreciated is a big thing to Wally. And he didn't think we were appreciated. I did, you know, but we were a duo, we were going together. City came to see us, said, would you join us? And I came up with a ridiculous amount of money, and they agreed to pay it. You know, so That's something I regret to me dying day, really. And without knocking him, because he's a wonderful man. It was more Wally's idea. I left and I should never have done it, because everything he promised. I think that was more a case of let's get them away from Radio Merseyside than the first time was. And it was much more programmed then as well. It was programmed to death. You know, don't sneeze unless it's scripted. You understand what I mean?
Radio City Gold. The beat goes on.
Oh, when I went to City, it was all medium wave. Because we went, it was City Gold when I went, and then they changed it to Magic.
Immensely different. You found that most of us fellas would be broadcasting in women's clothing. It's something we wanted to do for a while.
50 and Magic was a nightmare. As usual, somebody had the brilliant idea. Each of the DJs was on the time they're supposed to be on during the day. So the 7, I was doing 10 till 1 in the afternoon then. The 7 till 10 guy was on, and then 10 till 1 guy was on me. I think Stelly was on first then, and then me. Then I think Pete Price was doing 1 to 4, and then somebody doing 4 to 7. And we all played the same three records, one after the other. Magic by Pilot, Magic by Living in a Family Cooking, and Magic by Queen, one after the other. So just to get the name of the station in people's minds. And I said, yeah, by the time day two comes, you won't want to ever hear the word magic again. What did I know? So I stayed there for, I think it was 3.5, 4 years. Wally left, and then I left, and then, as I say, Mick Hall came in with an offer and was delighted to come back here again. That'll be 2000 when I come back here. But I mean, when I first came back, it was you're allowed to play three records of your own per show, no more than that, you know. And it's very hard. I mean, sometimes we get these guys come down and they'll be explaining why you're playing stuff. And I was probably the most argumentative one there. The guy would say, people are fed up with Buddy Holly. I'd say, no, they're not. They're fed up with hearing the same Buddy Holly record all the time. They're not fed up with Buddy Holly. They're fed up with the fact that you only play two Buddy Holly records. That's why they're fed up. And then he'd say, so-and-so, so-and-so. I said, I'll tell you what, you try and think of a different introduction to the same record day after day after day.
There you go, baby, here am I, oh, will you? So I could sit and cry.
I said, I know what the people out there want. I meet them, you know. So I'd be in constant harassment. But it's gone easier since then. Sue Owen's a great believer in, you know, the guys who are here know what they're doing, you know. So I'm okay. I'm giving me head, basically. Because in the early days, we actually broke records. We broke records in the 70s. There was a time when HMV had a Radio Merseyside section where you could go and buy the stuff we were playing.
The Lone Ranger.
I never get overawed. You know, if I'm interviewing somebody because they're alleged, that's fine. I can adjust to that, and that's fine. The most nervous I've ever been for an interview was when I interviewed the Lone Ranger. Because the Lone Ranger was a hero. He wasn't a legend, he wasn't, you know, a star. He was a hero. And these days when we record most things, I never recorded this because maybe I was nervous, maybe I didn't think I had to. Maybe I hadn't set it up yet. But I phoned the Lone Ranger in California, and the phone came up and the voice went, "Hi, this is Two Gun Jake. The Ranger's not available at the moment. Please leave a shot after this message." And I've always wished I'd recorded that. Please leave a shot after this message, you know. And then eventually did get him, you know. And thanks for coming on, Lone. I called him Lone all the way through, you know what I mean?
Governor, I learned a long time ago, it's wise to know a man before you place any trust in him.
The number of times people come to me and say, "You're my Sunday dinner. Oh, you remind me of roast beef," and things like that, you know. But as I said before, we just... I don't know what it is. We don't do half the stuff. We're now digital and everything. But we're not as adventurous as we were in the early days. Not at all. Whether it's due to the people at the top not being adventurous, I don't know. But we just don't do what we did so much in the early days. We don't go out all that much. You know, meeting the people who listen to us. I mean, we started doing a thing in 85, I think it was. We came up with this idea, and the radio station did Billy and Wally's Weekend at Pontins, where we took listeners away for Friday, Saturday and Sunday. And we did that for 28 years. We did 56 separate Pontins weekends, sold out nearly every single one of them, had one fight in those 28 years. And it all helps you, you're part of a family then.
Tune into BBC Radio Merseyside, 95.8 FM.
Now, the only difficulty I have on radio is recording programmes, because I know no one's listening. And that does affect me for a while, until I can get into it again. But knowing no one's listening isn't as easy to do as when you know all out there. I mean, I can see my audience. I can feel my audience, you know. And you must not forget the difference it makes to mention someone as well. You know, because you've been doing it for so long, you might think, oh, do a request for somebody. You know, if you do get a request and you forget to do it, you know, oh, God, what am I going to do? Because they've sat there for 2 hours waiting for that and he didn't get it. And it's important to them. And I'm a great believer in there's a piece of music for every occasion. You know, so if somebody has lost someone, pick the right kind of music. I mean, I remember once one of the bosses said to me, that's too personal. I said, no, it's not personal. It's how you present it. I always remember Charlie Gillett wrote in the NME. Charlie Gillett went round England, listened to all the local stations. And he said, Billy Butler from Radio Merseyside played, and he mentioned this record, say it was a soul record that went into a psychedelic record, that went into an Irish ballad. And Charlie Gillett put, this playlist is ridiculous unless you know how to talk into each record, which Mr. Butler does. And it's empathy as well. You know, if somebody's lost someone or somebody's ill and you play the right things. Coping with a playlist is the most challenging part of anybody's life. When you're interviewing a guy, having to play the same thing time after time is challenging. And after trying to convince the boss that something is a good idea, and you know it's a good idea. The difficult thing we have now, and I'm sure other people will tell you this, there are so many restrictions at the BBC now. Things, I mean, I go through some of the holds. Luckily, I've kept a lot of stuff. I'll go through our archives and I find myself editing stuff that was great then. But you know you won't get away with it now. Like, I did a spot called, you know, Gogglebox on the telly. I came up with this idea, Gigglebox. We do a Gigglebox where we have a comedian on for a minute telling jokes. And that was our Gigglebox. And so I'd edit all the stuff I had on comedians. And you take a local comedian you knew was very, very popular, was very, very funny, and you'd edit 5 minutes down to nothing because he cracked all Irish jokes and you can't play an Irish joke. So restrictions, I think, have taken away a lot of what you would like to do, you know. I did stuff at City that I don't do over here. For some reason, the commercial stations seem to be more okay with going a little bit over the top, you know what I mean?
We still have some great comedians in Liverpool.
I'm very, very lucky. In my second marriage since 1980. I got married again in 1984, I think it was. And the person I'm married to, you know, I can lean on for anything. And it really does help. If there's somebody behind you who believes in what you're doing, that makes things so much easier. And you're lucky. I'm dead lucky. I've had this job for 46 years. Look at the bonuses I've had off it and everything, you know. Well, it looks like we're only going to be remembered for Hold Your Plums. But I'd just like to be remembered for A, the laughter that people have had with me, B, the way I've made certain records be special to them. I mean, when I finish, which I will have to do eventually, I probably heard a piece of music which I think, oh, that's brilliant, but I can't share it with anyone. You know, I can't tell everybody how good this piece of music is or how good it might make them feel. Liverpool is famous for lots of things, music and comedy. And the Liverpool people, we laugh quicker than anybody else. And we cry quicker than anybody else. We're a very emotional type of people here in Merseyside. And in spot phonies as well.